You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on this first Monday of the new year, we all get down to business, right? A 22-state blizzard is so last week. A 25-state record deep freeze is what we may be facing here at the top of the week, at the top of the year. We'll have a bit more to say about climate turbulence in just a moment. We'll also take a romp across the potential 2014 risks with someone who is paid to watch all of the scary stuff out there in the world. Obviously, we should watch China and the Middle East, he says, but Turkey and Japan? Stay tuned. We'll also look at the radical change in the workplace wrought by the 40-hour work week 100 years ago by the man who brought us all one of the more recognizable work icons of all time, the pickup truck. Henry Ford drove the U.S. economy with his five-buck-a-day, eight-hour day that was quickly adopted by all of industrial America, except notably perhaps the United States Senate, which is back in session today. Question, who is more productive, 100 U.S. senators or one Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent? I know, unfair question. Todd wins that one.
Maybe you can't count.
So get some more guys and then it'll be an even fight.
Ooh, in the annals of even fights, we're also going to take a look at how long the U.S. will have the technological advantage in pilotless drones in the military and elsewhere. But we begin with climate change. As a record chill descends on much of North America this week, you may be motivated to look back at some of the more urgent warnings from folks like Nobel Prize-winning former Vice President Al Gore.
And I say it again tonight, we must reverse the silent rising tide of global warming.
And the chill this week reminds us of warnings from the scientific community about the consequences of human-induced climate change. Government scientist and controversial Columbia University researcher James Hansen started sounding the alarm about global warming back in the 1980s. The title of his 2009 book was called Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. Now, climate change skeptics seized on dire warnings like that as hyperbole and declared them just an excuse for liberals to take control of the U.S. economy or to impose taxes. They even called attempts to set a price for carbon emissions a carbon tax. Tax sounded worse than catastrophe in the politics of 2010, but ironically, one of the more persuasive arguments that climate change is real, persuasive especially to anti-tax conservatives, is how changing, unpredictable, and severe weather is increasingly exacting a tax on all aspects of life in America. A luxury tax if your yacht is damaged in an unexpected flood, or a regressive tax if you are a low-income worker who has to pay more for heat. Joining us now to talk about all this is Gary Yeo, professor of economics and environmental studies at Wesleyan University. Welcome, professor.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, professor, would you say that the early adaptations for dealing with the climate turbulence, global warming, whatever you want to call it, are basically the form of a kind of tax?
I think that the impacts in the associated risks from climate change and the dynamic climate system that's moving forward in ways we don't quite understand are the tax. The adaptations are, in fact, the way that you can things that you can undertake to reduce the burden of the tax, to reduce the magnitude of the tax. It's a lot like deductions that you can work out on your income tax.
And the question really is, and it's really a question for each individual consumer, depending on where they live and what the climate impact is, do you build in preventive investments to mitigate what might happen, kind of like the way you buy insurance? Or do you deal with it on the tailwind?
It is most efficient if you look at it as insurance, but it's a much harder concept to try to visualize, except for people who actually do buy insurance. Because if you're doing it in anticipation of the possibility that something bad might happen and trying to protect yourself to some degree against the consequences, what you're doing is buying into something that reduces a likelihood, a probability. It makes you feel more comfortable and confident, but it doesn't necessarily show up in anything that you could see. The event may not happen, and you won't know whether or not your investment would have paid off. But nonetheless, there are ways that the market is giving consumers signals that they are concerned about it. Insurance premiums for properties along the coasts are going up dramatically, 5-10 fold, because insurance premiums are starting to take into account the risks associated with coastal storms, but they're willing to give significant deductions on those premiums if homeowners undertake significant adaptations.
And the government is really just getting involved in this sort of thing. I mean, by subsidizing insurance rates and subsidizing the cost of living for people who do live in high-risk areas for so long, there's been a dampening effect of people coming to the realization that they really do need to make some of these investments. So the insurance model is also why it's hard for governments to make intelligent policy. They'd much rather, it seems, spend the higher costs of just dealing with the damage in the form of FEMA trailers, et cetera.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. But we are getting to the point where FEMA is redrawing the floodplain maps, and Congress is starting to get out of the way of that exercise. The president's climate action plan includes an enormous amount on preparedness and suggestions on how state and local governments and the federal government could work together to provide avenues and encouragement for people to undertake the responses that would be useful. But frankly, as an economist, what those government institutions have to do is create pilot programs that show that this stuff works and people can actually improve their welfare by undertaking those actions. And when that happens, there's room for the private sector to come in and take advantage of the opportunity.
Well, you have cautioned repeatedly that it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to assemble an aggregate number to describe this as a tax. So there's a limit to the tax metaphor here. But if we were to, you know, think as an economist does, is there a way to calculate whether the cost of living increase as a result of climate change, a way of thinking of that is it regressive? Does it fall more on the poor or more on the rich or more on some imaginary working class at this point?
Well, two responses to that. First of all, you can add up some of the things that we can quantify. Part of the problem is there is so much that we can't quantify in dollars and cents that those numbers are just significant underestimates of what might be considered the long-run discounted economic cost of emissions of climate change and the tax that it imposes through the environmental consequences. So that is one point. The second point has been known for 10 or 15 years on a global level from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and from a national level through a couple of national climate assessments that, in fact, these impacts are regressive and there are real issues of environmental equity that have to be taken into account.
All right. So pick your poison. Either call it a catastrophe that will destroy the human race or call it a tax. Either one is likely to motivate some sector of society as we think politically about the consequences of climate turbulence. Gary Yeo is a professor of economics and environmental studies at Wesleyan University. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
So soon to be a very chilly Todd Zwillick Takeaway Washington correspondent. Any chance conservatives on the Hill will heed the global warming alarms if they see it as something of a tax rather than as a catastrophe?
Oh, I would say if they saw it as something of a tax, it might have the opposite effect, John. You know, the idea of the carbon tax has been around on Capitol Hill a long time. It fell flat on its face, and that's why we landed with cap and trade, which fell right on its face. We're nowhere close to consensus on that issue right now.
Senate is in session today. Run down the agenda, if you can. I mean, there's the sort of the meat and potatoes of what the Senate has to do, and that involves unemployment insurance, but there's also some punctuation, some appointments that need to be confirmed.
Yeah, and that's all happening today, and there's some other longer-term issues coming up in the next couple of weeks. But just today, as soon as the Senate gets back, the first thing out of the gates is a confirmation vote for Janet Yellen to be the new chairman of the Federal Reserve. This is, of course, after an 8-year run by Ben Bernanke, 2 full terms, and Janet Yellen, I'm willing to predict, will be confirmed this evening. This is a straight up or down vote, not a 60 vote. She already passed that. You know, Janet Yellen was one of the first big officials, presidential appointments, who got a cloture vote under the new nuclear option Senate rule. So she's headed for confirmation this evening. Now, John, you mentioned some other big issues, economic issues. unemployment insurance benefits expired for 1.3 million short-term unemployed on December 28th. They have not gotten their check since. There's going to be a vote, a 60-vote threshold tonight in the Senate to extend benefits for just 3 weeks, unpaid for, Democratic initiative, but there is some Republican support and a Republican co-sponsor from a high unemployment state, and this vote's going to be close, and if it fails, it's going to be a big political issue as well, Democrats are promising.
Now, you know, the unemployment rate state by state makes this more of a bipartisan issue. I mean, I note that, for instance, in Tennessee, conservative Bob Corker and questionable conservative, but he mostly votes conservative, Lamar Alexander, are under some pressure perhaps to vote for the resumption of these benefits.
It is true in Tennessee there is some pressure, but let's look even further west for a second, John. Nevada, which has an unemployment rate of 9%, tied for the worst in the nation. Conservative Republican Senator Dean Heller's no dummy. He has high unemployment in his state, a horrible housing market, and he is co-sponsoring a $6.5 billion three-month extension of unemployment benefits unpaid for. And that's unusual to see this kind of bipartisanship on a deficit spending bill, which is what it would be. But he's the only Republican out supporting it so far. Democrats are obviously relying on Dean Heller, of course. He's a co-sponsor. But then on some other Republicans who've said that they're open to extending unemployment under certain circumstances. You mentioned Lamar Alexander from Tennessee. There are a couple of others. Maybe Mark Kirk, who's from the high unemployment state of Illinois. He's another one. But Republicans, John, haven't said they don't want to extend UI. They have said we don't want to do it without paying for it. That means spending cuts elsewhere in the budget. We can extend this, but we're going to keep cutting spending elsewhere. Here's the political problem with cutting spending elsewhere. Republicans are worried, and I've talked to a couple of them about this. The old argument about paying for unemployment insurance is fine, and they're willing to have it, except if you do that, you're opening yourself up to a lot of potentially difficult votes from Harry Reid. He says, you want to cut spending elsewhere? You want to pay for these unemployment insurance benefits? Fine. Let's vote on corporate jets and cutting subsidies for rich people. Let's argue, let's have a vote on taking the money from direct payments for rich farmers. All of a sudden, you get into an area where it gets some difficult votes for Republicans in some populous states. And so we're going to see where this goes.
Well, certainly that's an echo, that debate, the pay your own way for spending increases or for entitlement spending. Is an echo from 2010 with some, you know, echoes from even earlier than that. But that's really been the sort of standard operating procedure for the GOP on Capitol Hill since 2010. Are we going to see the rollout early in this Senate session of the Democrats' attempt to use income inequality as a political issue straight through to the 2014 elections?
Oh, well, there's no question about that. We've talked about it already. Democrats have sort of been quietly telegraphing this, around town. This unemployment vote is just the first page of this. Minimum wage is another one where Democrats are hoping to use minimum wage votes not only to increase the amplitude of their populist message, but also to maybe give an advantage to Democrats in some red states who are up for tough re-elections. Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, Kay Hagan in North Carolina, Mark Pryor in Arkansas. John, they've all got really, really, really tough races in the bid for Democrats to keep the Senate. But what's the other thing about those states? Tons of agricultural workers, tons of seasonal workers, and a lot of people working right at the minimum wage, where if minimum wage is on the ballot, those senators might do better. There's no question that in coming January, February, you're going to see an increased populist push on equality and minimum wage and UI from Democrats. You will hear the same message coordinated from the president on the dais at the State of the Union at the end of the month. So Democrats are definitely mounting an election year push on this issue.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Stay warm there, Todd.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, John. You too.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
As we explore the risks facing the world in 2014, one place where the U.S. faces a low risk of serious challenge is in its technological superiority in the use of pilotless drone aircraft. Being the undisputed master of drone airspace has produced military successes in Pakistan and made the U.S. some unplanned enemies in Afghanistan and Yemen, where drones have been blamed for civilian casualties. The trend over the next 5 years at the Pentagon, though, is for increased use of robotic weapons. Is this a good thing for national security? And can the U.S. even count on its global drone edge for that long? Clint Watts is a senior fellow at both the Homeland Security Policy Institute and at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Welcome, Clint.
Thank you.
How significant do you think this military technological advantage in drones is for the U.S., and how long do you think it will last?
I think it's a major step forward for the U.S., principally because of the situation the U.S. has been in over the past decade. We were fighting an asymmetric enemy that's scattered across many different countries around the world, and we found over time that occupying singular nations and rebuilding them was extremely difficult. And as soon as we did that, even if we were successful against a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda, they would move to the next safe haven.
Now, are you saying that we simply throw out the Tommy Franks book of the invasion of Iraq, even throw out the counterinsurgency textbook of General Petraeus and leap straight to drones as pretty much the singular strategy and tactic in dealing with Al-Qaeda and terrorism?
Definitely not. I think they each have their time and place. In 2002 and 2003, we were doing clear, hold, and build in Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to build nations, trying to turn them into democracies. That was extremely expensive, and it didn't work well. We tried doing interdiction, capture, and detention. And the ways we were doing that were primarily through secret prisons, rendition, and Guantanamo Bay. All three of those options were not well-liked, and rightfully so. And so those were taken off the table. So when you look at, across the entire history of the past 10 years, incrementally the public has found problems with each counterterrorism option that's being used and taken that back. And drones has been the most successful in terms of actually decapitating Al-Qaeda's leadership. And it's still up for debate whether it'll be entirely pulled off, but it's definitely been scaled back as well.
Well, you could certainly make the argument that that would apply to drones as well, and that we are sowing the seeds of that same kind of dissatisfaction, both in terms of angering people who we want to have as our friends in Afghanistan. And then the bigger argument, which is the more successful the U.S. is with drones, the more terrorists are going to want them, and you don't need Mohammed Atta to fly into the World Trade Center if you've got a drone to do it for you.
Well, on the first point, I don't think drones are effectively evaluated against other counterterrorism operations. For example, no one goes into the tribal areas and looks at the casualties, the civilian casualties and deaths involved in when we sponsor the foreign military of Pakistan to go into the tribal areas to hunt for Al-Qaeda members. No one's counting those civilian casualties. They do count drones. I think it's a good thing that we do. There needs to be accountability for it. But no one really investigates those other options. And I think if they did investigate those other options, they might be shocked at the civilian casualties that come out of it. And this is the debate over means and ends, really, is what it is. It seems like it's okay if we hand off responsibility to somebody else and essentially support them with money. The American public seems to find it more palatable. When we directly engage Al-Qaeda on our own and things don't go right, there's quite an upset audience waiting to pounce. Have they investigated those? Have they evaluated those? In my opinion, having spent a career working with the military, law enforcement, and intelligence, I would tell you drones, while not perfect and definitely need to be held accountable, are the least casualty-producing option that we have.
Although that argument suggests that we justify drones because we're killing civilians in much bigger numbers in other ways. I mean, I don't know if that's the best argument.
I'm just telling you, out of those three options, that is the one that is the least civilian casualty producing. And so then my counter argument to you is that you're saying we should not pursue Al-Qaeda in Pakistan at all.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the seeds for the unpopularity and ultimately the drone success will come back to bite us. What do you say about proliferation when terrorists start to get drones and can fly missions from their own bunkers?
I think this is a very far-off scenario. I think the more immediate concern with drone proliferation is that other foreign countries do exactly as we have done. They develop their own drone technology, and then they deploy it. But for terrorists, there are multiple components to the drone program. All we ever see is the scary pictures of the unmanned jet with missiles, but there's actually at least three more components. One is the actual intelligence that's on the ground that can lead to the actual strike. That is maybe the most important part of the whole program, and it's somewhat under-discussed and the media. The second part of it is you have to have a major telecommunications architecture to route those drones to wherever you want them to go. Terrorist groups are going to be limited to flying them essentially in a local or very regional area, probably at their best case.
But couldn't you make the same argument about nuclear technology that you need centrifuges, you need containment, and then along comes AQ Khan and hands off that technology to North Korea? The same could happen with the drones.
Right, but those are nation states, and you're compounding them with terrorist groups. Terrorist groups have tried desperately, especially Al-Qaeda. They would love to get a nuclear device, but it's much more complicated to execute that kind of an attack than what was previously made out in the media. For small-scale asymmetric terrorist groups, they're going to essentially have to acquire that from a nation state if they want to develop, much like nuclear technology.
All right, the drone future for the Pentagon and for the rest of the world. Clint Watts is a senior fellow at the Homeland Security Policy Institute and at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Thanks so much, Clint.
Thank you.
Are you whistling? Huh? Just starting your first shift of the first Monday of 2014? What are you going to do today? How many hours that is? Coming up in a moment, we'll be discussing the 100th anniversary of the 40-hour work week. How do you track your work hours? And how are you compensated for the time you put in? Are you a 24/7 worker or an 8/40 worker?
This is Joanna from Nashville. As a chef that specializes in in-home fine dining, sometimes I put a little extra effort in, unbilled, because I want to make something more special than what the allotted time allows. Sure, it comes out to working for free, but I love what I do so much that never feels like working.
Joanna in Nashville. Sounds like a good meal is at the end of that workday. Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. I'm into our, what would it be, probably close to three now? This is The Takeaway. Al-Qaeda is remaking the map of the Middle East, or at least they seem to want to. With the U.S. out of Iraq, civil war in Syria that has spilled over into Lebanon, Al-Qaeda has made a run for significant territory in the former site of the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy in Iraq. Anbar Province, long a center of Sunni Muslim insurgents, is now becoming a base for Al-Qaeda's wider ambitions to inflame sectarian tensions in the region. Longtime Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper joins us now. Patrick Coburn, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So if we look at what's going on in Fallujah and in Anbar province, what does Al-Qaeda's control signal to the region?
It signals, I think, that the Iraqi government can't control a very big chunk of its own territory. I mean, Anbar province, where this is happening, is a vast area. It's about one-third of western Iraq. I think it also says that Al-Qaeda is now stronger than it's ever been. I mean, I saw one Al-Qaeda slogan saying, now we rule from Diyala, which is a province just northeast of Baghdad, to Beirut. And they don't rule all of it, but they can make attacks in all this area.
You mentioned Anbar is a third of Iraq, which raises the question of whether Al-Qaeda's interest is essentially a partition of Iraq into a Shiite domain, a Sunni central domain, and we already basically have an Iraqi Kurdistan, have had since before the invasion of Iraq by the United States.
Yes, I mean, what Al-Qaeda say they want is to have a new caliph ruling over an area which ignores national boundaries and is based on religious boundaries. And the northeast and northwest and west of Iraq is predominantly Sunni, and so is the east of Syria. So they have a great pool of potential supporters there.
Iranian military officials speaking to the Associated Press suggested that Iran was ready to help Shiites in Iraq. Do you think that's a likely consequence of what's gone on in Anbar province?
No, I don't. I mean, Iran gives a lot of political support to Iraq. It's the most influential foreign power. But the problem for the Iraqi army is not really numbers. They've got about 900,000 men or even weaponry. It's really a lack of a political policy. And this has sort of played into the hands of al-Qaeda and destabilized the country.
Would you say that the instability in Syria has aided the al-Qaeda forces in Iraq, or is it simply a matter of good fortune that they have a battlefront both in Syria and Iraq at the same time?
No, it's aided them enormously. I mean, this is the crucial event that in 2010 they'd taken a lot of losses in the last 3 years. They've come back, and the primary change has been in Syria. And also they can bring fighters from Syria. People fighting in Fallujah in the last couple of days are said to have been reinforced by fighters from Syria, people who were fighting Assad previously.
Finally, if it is the case that there is an al-Qaeda flag from Beirut straight through to the outskirts of Baghdad, who is it that cannot tolerate such a situation if the international community isn't going to intervene in Syria and the Iraqi government can't really do anything on the ground in Anbar province?
I think they'll certainly try. They'll certainly fight. Iraq has a Shia majority. There's fighting in Syria. But I think, what's extraordinary is that so long after 9/11, after we've had all these foreign governments and intelligence agencies supposedly trying to eliminate al-Qaeda, that they seem to be stronger than ever.
Patrick Coburn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Patrick Coburn is the Middle East correspondent for The Independent. The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it started, folks.
Leave the house at 6 o'clock to be on time.
Monday morning, brand new year, back to the grind.
Leave the wife and kids at home to make a dime.
How many hours are you going to put in today? Count them. Someone is.
Grab your lunch pail, check for mail in your slot. You won't get your check if you don't punch the clock. Bus rider.
Whether or not a bus gets you to work today, punching a clock generally means getting your 8 hours. The 8-hour workday, which we design our days and weeks around, is a century old. Henry Ford's idea of strict clockwork organization for his industrial workforce turned 100 yesterday. Elizabeth Cohen is professor of history at Harvard University and dean of the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. She says Ford's 8-hour, $5 a day idea was a piece of radical social engineering that is still playing out in the U.S. economy.
We have to see the $5 day, the 8-hour work day, in the context of a struggle over power in the workplace. Henry Ford had this notion of creating the Model T, which he implemented in 1908, that would be a huge sales item. But what he needed to do that was a growing and secure labor force. And what he was faced with was a huge amount of absenteeism, a huge amount of turnover. And at the same time, and this is very important to remember, he had to figure out a strategy for really making the assembly line production process work. And the $5 day was part of that.
Well, let me just ask. I mean, did Ford run the numbers in some sense, in the sense that he said, all right, if my workers and the industrial workers who are part of my competition all behaved in this way, we might see these economic consequences in terms of leisure time, disposable income, those sorts of things? Or did these things just sort of happen?
What you have to realize is that it wasn't just $5 for every day. Basically, it was divided into two parts. Half of it was a wage that every worker got. The other half was what was considered profit sharing. At the same time that the $5 day went in, so was created something called the sociological department, which went into workers' homes and observed if they were, in fact, practicing good behavior at home. Were they thrifty? Did they avoid drinking? So you only got the profit sharing half every 2 weeks if, in fact, you lived up to those expectations.
Let's talk a little bit about the creation, because of the $5 a day wage, of a middle class with enough disposable income to actually buy Ford products.
I do think that the $5 day inaugurated a very important dimension of 20th century capitalism that really prevailed until the great recessions of the 1970s. And that is to think about workers as consumers as well as producers. So in the 1920s, there were efforts to encourage mass consumption. Here it was mostly middle-class consumers who were given incentives through installment buying and so forth. The 1930s, Roosevelt and the New Dealers recognized that increasing aggregate demand was going to be the best way out of the Great Depression. And they did that. The war only encouraged that in terms of the kinds of savings that people were able to have after, you know, a decade of depression. And then when the war ended, they went, you know, out into the marketplace with great enthusiasm to spend those savings. And the prosperity of the post-war period was really built around workers as consumers as much as producers. So today, we are still very dependent on consumption for our economy. But when somebody goes to buy, they are no longer thinking of that purchase as fueling that machine of that unbroken circle. You go and you look for the cheapest price you can find for the sake of getting a cheap price, not to keep your neighbor employed. It's very, very different notion of what prosperity means.
Elizabeth Cohen is professor of history at Harvard University and dean of the Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard. Elizabeth, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Working from 9 to 5, oh, 9 to 5, 9 to 5, working from 9 to 5.
If the 8-hour day was the radical idea of work a century ago, what is the radical idea today? 8 hours might sound radical to those of you working multiple jobs in multiple income households. Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org and tell us how your work is measured. Is it a clock, timesheets, billable hours, honor system? Just tell us. These days, some sectors of the workforce are embracing radically flexible ideas of where and when to work, while some tech companies like Yahoo are trying to rein all that in, while other professions expect you to work all of the time. And you know who you are. One of you in Eugene, Oregon. I'm a first-year kindergarten teacher. I get compensated for 4 hours a day. I put in twice that, plus nearly every waking hour planning, organizing, and searching for ways to improve myself and my students. I'm compensated by a sense of purpose and delight in spending my time with 32 tiny people.
Martina Moss, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. I am one of those lucky people that have a job they love. I get to be part of making a life-saving medicine. I have regular work hours, but my phone is always on. I work whenever I'm needed, and I don't mind at all.
Joining us now is Pamela Hines, Associate Professor of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford University. Pamela, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Pamela, your colleague Elizabeth Cohen at Harvard says that with his 8-hour day, Ford started a revolution between employers and workers. From your perspective as a co-director for the Center for Work Technology and Organization there at Stanford, are workers winning or losing the battle in 2014? And are number of hours worked even a meaningful measure of anything anymore?
So most of the workers that I study are professionals, and I would say that very, very few of them are working only 8 hours a day or only 40 hours a week. It's hard to say whether they are winning or losing. You know, it's interesting to hear some of the callers earlier saying, you know, like the teacher from Oregon saying that she, you know, has a sense of purpose in her job, the woman who is making life-saving medicine and loves that. You know, we also see that in the workers that we're studying. It's a balance between, you know, really having a sense of purpose in the work that they're doing and also trying to have some kind of work-life balance.
You know, Henry Ford, of course, invented the assembly line where the jobs were very chain-oriented and, you know, narrowly structured. I mean, you didn't really see the big picture in producing the car. I'm wondering if in a service economy, it's easier to find that sense of satisfaction in certain sectors. It's easier to sort of define your job according to your personality and still remain productive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly among the workers that we study, there's a lot more autonomy. People are making a lot more decisions about how to approach their job, what to do in their jobs. A lot of the workers that I study are globally distributed. So they're working with people in India, in China, in other parts of the globe. And there's a real sense of satisfaction and learning. What we hear a lot about is people love sort of stretching themselves and learning new things and learning about new cultures and traveling, and that brings a real sense of satisfaction.
So technology drove the industrial economy at the turn of the 20th century, and the consensus was, I think, socially, was that technology in the workplace was, on balance, dehumanizing. Would you say the technology being used in the workplace today in the growth sectors of the economy that you study is dehumanizing or more humanizing?
Well, it's a combination of both. On one hand, all of the new communication technologies, with email and video conferencing and knowledge management systems or shared document repositories and all of that, enables people to work with a lot more people at a distance. They don't have to be at their desks to do it. So in that sense, it allows a lot more flexibility. On the other hand, it disconnects people from one another in some sense. I think there's a bit of overconfidence that we can actually work effectively with people over these technologies. And we tend to forget how much interaction with our colleagues and how much work actually happens outside of meetings and depends heavily on trust and familiarity with the people with whom we're working.
And that was, of course, the Yahoo argument for trying to rein in flex time to a certain extent. I'm wondering what impact, and again, I know you don't have numbers on this, but what impact technology has on workers who know they're being watched, who maybe are coming increasingly aware of the fact that all of their communications are essentially corporate property on some level.
Yeah, among the people that I study, we do a lot of field studies. Mostly, as I said, we study professionals. So that would be engineers, product designers, architects, and so forth. And I think there's an awareness that they are or could be watched. But I don't think that it has a big effect on people's daily work activities.
So it's not a big brother sense. It's really just sort of an element of the cost of doing business, like, bad coffee comes from the machine a generation ago. It's not something that causes a great deal of anxiety.
Yeah, I do not sense that it does.
What about the issue of flexibility and flex time? Do people really have this flexibility, or is it something that companies tend to regulate much more?
That's a really interesting question. They do. They actually have a tremendous amount of flexibility. And the idea is that, people can, go do their grocery shopping or get their hair cut in the middle of the day. But then they also may need to be, up on a conference call at 6 a.m. With India or up until 10 or 11 p.m. with China. The reality, though, is that most workers don't take advantage of that flexibility. What we see is that they're still at work during the middle of the workday, as well as working much earlier and much later. And part of the challenge is that they're collaborating, say, with people in India and China, but they're also collaborating with people locally who are working during that traditional 8-hour workday. So if you're going to collaborate with people during the same time that they're working, you really need to span a very large number of hours.
Sounds like an epitaph for the 8-hour day. I wonder if Henry Ford would think of it as backsliding if he were alive today, or some kind of a brave new world. Pamela Hines, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pamela Hines is professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University, where she also co-directs the Center for Work, Technology, and Organization.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's the predictable, and then there's the shot from out of nowhere. Thinking back 12 months ago, those making predictions for 2013 could have safely noted climate change, Russia, China, instability in Europe, and the divided U.S. Congress as sources of risk last year. But who could have predicted a pope would step down for the first time in six centuries? His replacement would all but renounce capitalism? Or that some obscure government contractor would prove that the U.S. is using its technological edge to spy on virtually everyone in the world? Sorting out the safely predictable and the dangerously unpredictable and assessing risks for the coming year is Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group, a global political research and consulting firm which publishes a yearly list of the top risks to watch. Ian, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to see you. Happy New Year, sir.
When you're looking for risks to be concerned about in 2014, what kinds of things are you looking for?
We're looking for near-term. We're looking for large scale. We're looking for likelihood. So clearly, we know that the war in Syria is going to persist. But frankly, violence is likely to be less than we saw in 2013. It's certainly not considered strategically important by any of the major powers in the world. It's going to fall off that list. In fact, it's a red herring for 2014. The impact that the major players have, the impact that they can have, the world's largest economies, when they can change, are clearly the things that move the most.
All right. So the Middle East is certainly a place to watch, but you wouldn't say that it's a game changer for the entire world going forward.
No. In fact, one of the big issues we're going to see in 2014 is that oil prices are going down. That's true in part because despite violence in Libya and Iraq, their production is going to increase significantly in 2014. And we're going to see lots more coming on in the Western Hemisphere, particularly the U.S., where we're expecting a minimum of a million additional barrels a day. So the pressure on the Middle East is actually coming from increasingly low oil prices that are squeezing their economies even more than we've seen over past years. That's going to be hard on Egypt. It's going to be hard on Tunisia. It means that radicals across the region who say they're supporting the disenfranchised and greater sectarian fights are going to grow. But the interest of the United States and other major powers in playing a significant role in that part of the world is going down.
Declining oil will be hard on Putin, if not Russia, which is partially why Russia is on your list.
Well, it's clearly going to be hard on Russia. The question is how much Putin cares, right? I mean, a lot of people have said that 2013 was a great year for Putin, and he's hosting Sochi. He's going to be the president of the G8 this year. He's got the Syria deal under his belt. But the fact is that his economics are deteriorating significantly, and he's presently at his lowest levels of popularity since he was elected, quote unquote, in 2000. So Putin's a very capricious individual. He's certainly the world's most powerful person. In fact, the only person I could think of that's more powerful than he is Putin himself several years ago. And the willingness of Putin to do something destabilizing and volatile in his own country or on their borders is actually quite significant.
Of course, everybody watches the Middle East. Everybody watches China. And we'll talk about China in a moment. Turkey and Brazil are interesting cases in point for different kinds of reasons.
For very different reasons. I mean, a lot of emerging markets are becoming more risky in 2014. And in part, that's true because every one of them that's significant, that's having, that could have elections in 2014, is having an election. China doesn't have them. Russia doesn't have real elections. But all the rest of them are. Turkey's and Brazil's are going to be interesting in very different reasons. Dilma Rousseff in Brazil is heavily favored to win, will win easily. She's not going to support big reforms in that country, but she is going to be more fiscally conservative, and the markets will gradually move back to what is a stabilizing Brazil story as we get towards the end of 2014. That is not the case in Turkey at all. The geopolitics of the region are turning against them. They were much more favorable. Their ability to cut deals internally with the rest of Kurds becoming much more problematic. And Erdogan wants to be like Putin, but his political institutions are not sufficiently pliable to his will to allow that. And so what we're going to see is that the willingness of the international community to say Turkey's not a good story, despite all the education, despite all the competence in the business community, despite the credibility of the technocrats, Turkey's going to have a very rough, a decidedly rough 2014.
And they're in a tough neighborhood, that's for sure. Okay, what about China?
Well, I think China's interesting because they are actually, for the first time, starting real reform. Right? We've seen more reform in Xi Jinping's first 6 months than we'd seen in the previous 20 years. We should believe in that. That's true structurally in terms of new political institutions put in place like the National Security Council. It's true in terms of economic reforms, anti-corruption measures, financial reforms, the free trade zone they've developed in Shanghai. But these things to be implemented, they're necessary. We've been saying they're necessary for years and years and years, but they're also dangerous because they create losers, internal losers. I mean, real anti-corruption goes after entrenched individuals that have real power in China. All of this means that for the first time in a long time, there's actual risk, risk of instability within China as these reforms engage, and also risks externally because the willingness of this Chinese government to try to channel discontent at external problems, particularly Japan. There's no question in my mind that 2014, the single most important geopolitical bilateral conflict in the world is China-Japan.
Wow. Iran, wild card or beacon of hope?
2014 is the year of reckoning. We either get a real comprehensive deal done or we don't, or we fail. But if a deal doesn't happen, the Iranians are then moving fast towards nuclear capacity. They're about 2 months away from breakout nuclear capability at that point. So the choice that has to be made by the international community, what do you do in that environment? Do you go with a real harder line? Would you even consider military strikes? Those questions all get resolved in the next 8 months.
We saw Snowden last year come out of nowhere and transform the national security game. Do you see anything like that happening? Do you see anything in U.S. domestic politics changing the game in 2014?
I'll say very clearly, in 2013, our list was fantastic and, in my view, pretty prescient. We kept it, you know, online all year. Snowden came from nowhere. I mean, even once Snowden happened, I was quite surprised with the extent of the damage that could be caused by one individual and his ability to collect data. It'll be interesting if to what extent we continue to believe at the end of 2014 it was one individual. I don't see much happening domestically in the U.S. because the stability is there, the growth is picking up. What I think will happen, in part because of Snowden but for other reasons too, is the impact of U.S. foreign policy is going to be much greater on other countries around the world. And the absence of perceived American leadership, the absence of America's willingness to follow through on commitments to its allies, and the absent American interest in playing the role of not only a global policeman, but, you know, as we see, the U.S. is even less popular as a global private investigator than it has been historically as a global policeman.
Talking to Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group, a global political risk research and consulting firm. You know, I think of you as kind of the original running with scissors in geopolitics guy. You're the guy who says, be careful with that 2014. Here's what can hurt you. Here's the thing. Here's the stuff that's gonna be unsafe about this perfectly fine year that we've got going here. Do you only see the downside?
Oh, absolutely not. Plenty of upside. What's interesting about 2014, for the last 5 years, the biggest worries in the world have largely been economic. They've been, you know, U.S. debt limit, financial crisis, Japan debt issues, Eurozone falling apart, hard landing in China. 2014, most of those economic risks are really off the table. But the political risks, the geopolitics are very much in play in 2014. So it's a real shift in the way we think about what are the kinds of things that are going to make running with those scissors a little sharper and more painful for us.
Well, if somebody puts their eye out, another Snowden, an outlier that we haven't predicted in this list, we'll give you a call.
Please do, sir.
All right. To Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So what's the risk you're going to put in some overtime today? I write my hours in a little pad every day. One of you writes from Brooklyn. My job is constantly trying to short people hours, unfortunately. How do you track the hours you work? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.